Welcome to Work From Your Happy Place, the podcast that equips you with the tools, know-how, and motivation to live your dreams and find your happy place. Be sure to sign up for our free weekly newsletter for a recap of the week's guests and a preview of what's in store. To sign up, simply text the word happy place with no space to 33444. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce the host of Work From Your Happy Place, Belinda Ellsworth.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Work From Your Happy Place. I'm your host, Belinda, and I am so excited about our show today. I have Gregory Jabara with me, and I'm especially excited. It's so much fun when you personally know the individual, and you're going to get to know him during this episode as well. Gregory Jabara is currently starring as DCPI Garrett Moore on the CBS police drama Blue Bloods, now in its 12th season. He is the winner of the 2009 Tony Award for Best Featured Actor in a Musical for his performance as Dad in Billy Elliot, the musical, and is the voice of Pastor Wilson Knox in the popular Adventures in Odyssey radio series. It is my pleasure to welcome Greg to our show today.
Belinda!
Yeah!
How crazy. This is great. Love technology.
Oh, I know. It's so much fun.
It is. Where are you? What room are you? Are you have a studio there or are you someplace in your house?
We do have a studio in the house. So right.
I have this... a walk-in closet. That's where I am.
Okay. You know what? There's a lot of people that have walk-in closets as their studios these days.
Yeah. I do a lot of work here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, the second best place that I go and try to get work done if Chris's studio is being occupied is my pantry, which is like a closet. So that works out for me well, too. When I really need a soundproof room, I go to my pantry.
Yeah, makes absolute sense.
Absolutely. So, Greg, let's just dive into this. Let's kind of fill everybody in on this bio and kind of tell us a little bit about your journey and let us get to know Greg Jabara a little bit better.
So did you archive the thing we did like 5 years ago?
I did.
Okay. So everybody can go back and get all the really fine details about like childhood where Belinda and I grew up in suburban Detroit. And we got to go to a public school system that offered all kinds of great opportunities. And then I got accepted by a very narrow margin into the University of Michigan. And then while I was there, all my teachers there said, you really need to go to a better school. And they encouraged me to audition for the Juilliard School, which I got into. And then that was 4 more years. So it took me 7 years to get my bachelor's of arts degree. And then I pretty much started working right out of the gate, not only in catering and cocktail waiting, but actually with acting jobs. And then that was 1986 and about 15 years of predominantly Broadway and New York stage work. Although my first on-camera commercial was for the Detroit Free Press, which is our hometown, obviously, which was kind of just a wacky coincidence. The casting people, they didn't even know that I was from Detroit when I auditioned, but I thought that was a good omen for my career path.
And then, oh gosh, for sure.
You know, after the last Broadway show I did in New York was Billy Elliot, and that dovetailed with this amazing TV job that, as you had mentioned, we're about to start our 12th season in July, which is like pinch me reality, because it's like a miracle just to be able to feed yourself, let alone have this kind of job security. So, you know, it's been just a meteoric, dreamlike Cinderella story with absolutely nothing ever going wrong, ever. No hardships, never lost any sleep, never had any problems as a father, husband, or ex-husband. You know, a lot of things, just perfect life. Are you buying any of that? Because for the first time, my nose did not poke a hole in the screen of my computer from lying.
There you go. It's it always looks great from the outside looking in, but there's always a journey. There's always trials. There's always mishaps. There's always that on the brink of, am I going to even be able to, you know, do this anymore? And so I'm sure you had to have those kinds of moments, feelings.
Those events were literally the things that catapulted me to the next sort of little oasis of hope. And then for example, What's a really good example? I can even in, during my Broadway days, and I'll keep this brief, but you know, there were for Billy Elliot, the show for which I won the Tony Award, the casting director didn't even think I was right for that show. And I literally had to campaign and fly myself from Los Angeles to New York to audition, knowing that the first person in the front, the casting director, didn't think I was the guy to do the part. Thank goodness that I had an opportunity to deal with the director and the rest of the creative team on that show. But, you know, it was like, I had to go, oh, but I had to do it because we were living in LA and my wife and I were literally laying awake at night wondering, where's the next dollar coming from? Because we'd moved to Los Angeles and this would have been 2000. This was the second journey. Back in 2004 was when there was a real runaway production problem in Los Angeles. We moved to LA so that I could get a TV and film career so that I could go back to New York and star in Broadway shows, because that's kind of the way it worked. At the pinnacle, or what seemed like the pinnacle of my Broadway career, I was auditioning against every major TV and film star that wanted to do a Broadway show. And that's who I was losing the job to, were personalities that had box office draw that would help producers. And so I moved to LA. And then when I got to LA, all of the production left Los Angeles and went to Canada and Michigan and Georgia and Texas and Louisiana. So there was much less opportunities here. And we were going, wow, I may have to just think about taking a job back in New York in a Broadway show, which then miraculously turned into Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. And then that ended because our kids were old enough to go to school, and the school that a friend of mine founded from the University of Michigan, who was a friend of mine, she founded a charter school in LA. We moved back to LA because our kid could go to a Waldorf charter school that would be paid for by our taxes instead of the $25,000 for half-day kindergarten that we paid for him to go in New York City. And it was like, you know, necessity and practicality. So I had to leave my Broadway job so that my family could have some stability and foundation. And then 2 years after that, we're like going, and there's still no more money coming in. And then I had to go, let's throw our hat in the ring for the Billy Elliot job, which they weren't even interested in me for. But because of a lot of little miracles that I pushed hard and took some risks, and they hired me. And then that turned into the Tony Award, which became the most amazing business tool that you could ever hope for. And ultimately really was a big factor in my deciding to try and get that job, because it's like, if I'm going to go be away from my family, what will it do for me business-wise? It's not just going to be because I get to go and sing and dance and listen to people applaud me and tell me how great I am 8 times a week, but it's like, you have to kind of think about what will be the next step. And if I could get a Tony nomination, let alone a win, it could hopefully give me more clout. And gratefully, you know, end of Billy Elliot, Tom Selleck, who was a very loyal business friend who we had met when I did the movie In and Out almost 15, 20 years earlier. This was his wife, Jilly, who's she was the original white cat in Cats on the West End. So she's all about musical theater, and I think holds a very special place in her heart for me, because, you know, I come from musical theater. But I always say it's probably Jilly who said, well, what about Greg Chabarro, who just won the Tony, and he can you give him a job on your new TV show? And, you know, and I ended up getting a 2-arc episode, and that was going to be it, after auditioning 3 times before earlier in their first season and nothing, no interest, not even a, oh yeah, maybe. It was like crickets. But then a character came up. He literally said, I want Greg Jabbar to play this part. And that was like, you know, you're hearing choirs of angels, like the what was that Polovetsian dance number, whatever, where that sounds like romantic orchestral piece. You go, oh, Tom Selleck still loves me. And then that 2 episodes turned into 12 seasons now. But, you know, there are 95% of the actors who are in this industry would love to have the journey that I've had so far. And I totally agree with them. I pinch myself every day. But let's look at just the COVID year. And this also happened with Billy, I don't know. Do you remember me telling you the story about Joe Aki being at our house when I got the call that I had gotten Billy Elliot, the musical? Did I ever tell you? Do you remember that story at all? Do you think it's, he was there. He was visiting us. Joe Aki went to high school with
yes.
Belinda and I back in Michigan. And my agent called and Julie and I went into the master bedroom and we left the doors open to the hall. And he was on speakerphone, my agent, Michael Kelly Boone. And he said, "You got the gig." And Julie started to cry, not with tears of joy, but in realizing that, oh, we've established our home back in LA. Our boys are in a school that really is the foundation of who they are today as grown men. And we wouldn't have changed a thing. But we knew that to keep them here in a school without constantly changing their world, I was going to be alone in New York. And go out by myself. And my wife was going to have to stay home and raise these boys primarily on her own. And we came out of the room and we looked like someone had just told us somebody died. And Joe, I remember Joe going, "Okay, this is not what I was expecting it to be like when someone gets the phone call from their agent that they just got a lead role in the hottest new Broadway musical." And it was like, and Julie had said something to the effect of, "Yeah, we now realize that if Craig chooses to take this, we're going to be apart for who knows how many years so that we can afford to pay our mortgage and our kids can have food on the table." And it, that was just like one of many really just sort of difficult decisions. And, thank God we did it. It was lonely. It was very hard. But it did pay off because then I ended up ultimately with a TV job that was only supposed to be two episodes, but I commuted pre-COVID, which meant I would fly to New York. I'd shoot two episodes, like over 5 to 10 days, whatever was needed for the amount of my character's work in those two episodes. And then I got to fly home and be home for at least 2 weeks. So it wasn't as brutal emotionally as being apart for, 3 years with when I would, Julie and the boys would come to New York when they were on vacation from school during the summer and at Christmas. But, back then it was iChat and then it became FaceTime, the Apple video apps. Without that technology, we wouldn't have survived that time away. It would have, who knows what would have happened. I actually ended up after my first year under my contract at Billy Elliot, they had said, "We want you to stay on." And I said, "I can't, I have to go home." And Stephen Daldry said, "Well, how much time do you need home?" He goes, "I totally get it. You need to go home. How about we give you 3 months home? I'll bring in one of the dads from the West End. We'll have it make it sort of an event that we bring one of our West End actors to come play your role. And then you get the 3 months you need. And then you come back and stay with us till we're done." And it was like, oh, and Julie and I both agreed, went, okay, that might be able to do that. Yeah. But that was a negotiation, thank goodness. Sure. Thank goodness it was Stephen Daldry, our director, who said yes, because if it had been our lead producer, now I'm blocking his name because I'd like to work with him. He actually gave me a movie job later, but I ran into him on the street soon, right after. It was before maybe I'd already come back from my 3 month hiatus. It's the first time I'd seen him. He goes, "Well, it's a good thing that Steven had said," because he goes, "If it was up to me, I would have said no, bye. He goes, "Either you're here or you're gone." But these are also the same producers who, they're from London. And as London producers, if they're producing theater, they assume, because all the actors are in London. It's not like the United States where you have a hub of actors in Los Angeles and you have a hub of actors in New York. And if you want an actor who lives in LA, you're going to have to at least offer some relocation money and or maybe a little stipend or per diem to help cover cost of living, because their home is not in New York City. And the London producers were all about, like, that was the next hurdle, was then, when we got that phone call, "Greg, you got the job on Billy Elliot," then we went, okay, well, they're going to have to go. These are all the things we need, because the Broadway show I had done just before that, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, those were American producers. They understood. They provided us housing. They gave us round trip tickets to go back and forth if we needed to. It was like, that's what you do when you hire an LA actor to work in New York. And the British said, nope, we don't do that. And it was like, okay, then I can't do this job, and had to walk away. And I'm sure it was Stephen Daldry who every time goes, what are you doing to their producers? This is the guy who needs to play the role. And this is how they do things. And you're going to have to find a way to get beyond the template that you're used to in London. And gratefully, you know, it's everybody saying no, 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 until somebody acquiesces and we meet somewhere in the middle, you know? Mm-hmm. But that job alone was a lot of, this could go away. And
right.
not knowing, you know, what the opportunity could be down the road.
Let's talk a little bit about this past year. So
COVID life.
It's been crazy, right? And what's it like being on a hit show? I'm sure it kind of stopped production at least momentarily and then had to resume. And so what's that been like for you as an actor and as a show that has gone on now and we've got to watch it this past season?
Yeah, you realize how much you take for granted. We had 2.5 episodes left to go of season 10. We had 2.5 episodes. We were in the third to last episode of season 10. And that was like March 15th. I was at home during my 2 weeks at home phase, but they had already said, hey, here's your travel. We're going to fly you back next week on this day and you'll start work. And then on the afternoon of that day, an email went out to the entire company that said they shut the show down that day. I guess they finished that shoot day. And then they said, we're closing everything down and we don't know when we're coming back. And initially, optimistically, everybody's going, you know, this is only going to be a couple of week thing. Mm-hmm. The unions are getting together. CBS is working really hard to figure out what will it take so that we can continue safely doing production. And that was March 15th. It wasn't until And initially, our executive producers were great. We were getting an email every week, kind of updating everybody with what they know so far. And then it started becoming, after about a month, it became every 2 weeks. And then a month later, it was like once a month. And then there was a time where we weren't hearing anything. And it was like, we don't know. We're hoping for, but we have no answers. And then suddenly, because we started back the first week of October, and it wasn't until literally 2 weeks before that they were able to say, all right, we've dotted all the I's. We have all of our COVID testing facilities lined up. We know what it's going to take to travel people and blah, blah, blah. It's official. You are Greg. We're flying you out on this day and you're starting here. And then to get to set, well, that meant testing, COVID testing. That was the other thing. Before it actually started, I sat down with my wife and we agreed that we had to, I was concerned that I would become undesirable as a hire because I'm out of town and the commute thing was not going to be able to, that they wouldn't want to do. Well, it didn't make sense to commute anymore because the potential for exposure on airplanes was not smart. And so we proposed to them, we said, look, we're willing to, because 3 years on Billy Elliot, I'm thinking, 7 months with maybe the opportunity to go home at Christmas just to have this job security. When now we've got one kid in college and another one, a junior in high school, and we can't afford to not have any income coming in anymore. So how about you put me in an apartment that's 5-minute walk from the sound stages. I'll be able to, instead of you having to send a driver to pick me up from my hotel, my really nice hotel at Madison Square Park that I was racking up Marriott points every time I stayed there, that I was able to use to have vacations with my family that I could never afford to do on my own. Had to kiss that goodbye. And believe me, I'm not crying because it was like, okay, put me in an apartment and I'll walk myself to work. I'll walk myself every other day to get my COVID tests. You don't have to hire a Teamster transfer driver to come pick me up. I walk myself. I'll self-report. It's going to save you a ridiculous amount of money on to get an abandoned apartment because there was a mass exodus from New York City. Yeah. So they were spending like just tens of thousands less for the entire season to put me in this apartment. And they always had me here. They never had to worry because there were days when I had my commuter life where Julie and I would be going to bed at, you know, on a Sunday night, and I'd get the email from our production coordinator saying, "Hey, Greg, here's your travel memo. You're going to be flying out. We're going to fly you out on your usual 9 a.m. flight on Thursday, and your first day of work will be Friday." And like, you get that email, and then we're in bed, and then the phone rings, and it's production. They're going, "We've lost a set due to weather, and we can't get the permits for the day we need. So we need you to be here tomorrow. So we're picking you up at, you know, a car will be at your door at 5 a.m. and you're on that first flight out and you've got a beer." And it's like, you know what? Of course I'm there, because mm-hmm. technically I'm being compensated as if I work eight days a week for each episode, but I don't. I've never worked 8 full days on a single episode. So for them to go, "We need you here, get on a plane," it's like, "You bet. Yes, sir. I'm on it." And my wife and I realized that, you know, that's part of the give and take of the job, that you can't count on anything when I'm home, because I could get snatched up at any time to have to go back. Well, now that it's COVID, they're like going, "Oh, this is highly desirable, because now Greg is here. We don't have to deal with that madness of they have a lot more freedom with scheduling," which they turned out they needed. Our very first episode, they weren't able to get all the actors they needed tested and the results back in time so they could work on that first Tuesday. But I was there and I had already gotten my test results back and I was eligible. So they rewrote the first scene of the first episode that had Garrett, Gormley, Baker, and the commissioner. They wrote out Gormley and Baker because they hadn't even tested yet, because they weren't expected to start working until Thursday. They rewrote it because I was there, and Tom and I were able to work that day and save a day of shooting simply because I happened to be there. So even right out of the gate, they're going, "Oh, there's big benefits to having actors nearby." And I felt better not flying in airplanes, because there was a lot of stupidity and a lot of pushback, you know, in people that were flying, and irresponsibility too. There were people that were sick that were getting on airplanes.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was just nice not to have to deal with that. But the workplace, it wasn't until we got to work that I realized how much I depended on the socialization of that environment, that I talked to, you know, the boom operator, the focus pullers, the second and third tier prop people, all the wardrobe people, the girls that are carrying your costumes, let alone the ones who are on set watching you, the sound mixer, everybody. You're used to when they yell cut, then you can go and socialize. Or if you're between takes or they're turning around a shot, we're all hanging out in the same space and getting to find out how everybody's lives are and what's going on and who wants to meet for a drink or go somewhere for dinner after we're done today. And all that was gone because the COVID protocols were that the actors only saw other actors, and literally only saw other actors. All of the entire crew, they put new doors on the sound stages so that the traffic for crew members to come in and out of the sound stages was completely different and the opposite of the opposite end of the room than the traffic that the actors had. And they never let the actors enter the sound stage until all of the crew had left the set and were in other sequestered areas in the soundstage. And then the actors would come in and we didn't see anybody. Literally couldn't even wave to people except for the poor boom mic operator who was wearing a hazmat outfit and standing in the room with us. And I just felt for him because you knew he was sweating like the bejeepers there. But we didn't even have the cameras that were in the commissioner's office. We used to have 3 cameras with an operator, a dolly grip, and a focus puller all right there. And the 3 cameras were gone. We only had 2 cameras and they're now robotic. So there's not a single human being in the room except for the boom operator and the 3 or 4 actors that are in the scene. So it was like the human contact aspect of the workplace was really diminished. And it took a long time to get used to it. I can honestly say I never liked it. I miss our whole crew. I actually stayed an extra couple of days at the end of the season just so that I could go to the wrap party, which was about 5 food trucks in one of our parking lots outdoors with all the social distancing, but just so I could actually see and say hello to the crew that I took advantage of having access to for, 10 years. It was, it was really strange, but we were successful. And that in and itself is a huge tip of the hat to there. We had a few days that, it never made it to the press, but we had a couple of days where we had to pause for a couple hours while they reran some tests to find out who was. And then if they found somebody was, because you were not catching COVID in the workplace, the firewalls they had in place were so amazing. And we were all in separate pods. So there was no interaction, between departments. So if someone did get it from home or outside of their own social life, if they came to work, it was going to be a limited exposure. And that did happen. One time we did have one of our, the wardrobe department, they ended up, they had to shut the show down for actually two and a half working days, but they also had Saturday and Sunday in between to do the scramble to find, to rehire, to get hire people that could come and do the job so that we could resume work on they were tested positive on a Thursday. We shut down midday Thursday and we were back to work on Tuesday. So unlike some shows that it was so hard and it's also very expensive. There were millions of dollars spent outside of just for the COVID budget. And we're talking to staff, the testing trailers, to pay for all the laboratory processing. And it was quick turnaround. These were, nasal swabs that they could have results in 8 to 10 hours. So it wasn't cheap. All the PPE that everybody had to wear was provided by the show. So it was a major expenditure, but it paid off. And we were successful where a lot of shows, first of all, didn't have the budget to even attempt that, or they had to close down so many times early on that they just said, we're going to stop because we can't control it. But everybody on the show had a new appreciation. I had a new appreciation for how interdependent we all were. If I get sick, it's going to mess up everybody's job. I mean, literally everybody. It shuts down work. And, nobody wants to be that person. So there really was a real display of selfless focus. Nobody really liked it, just in terms of the socialization being gone. But we all were grateful to have a job, which was a miracle.
Right.
And the end result was we were seeing the dividends of if everybody stays on point, everybody just takes care of yourself when you're outside the workplace so no one's bringing anything in, we're going to be fine. And we did. And that was amazing. And I'm very proud of that accomplishment. But it was a lot of hard work and great planning on the part of both CBS and specifically our production coordinators on the show.
Wow. Well, I'm so glad you shared that. I'm sure a lot of people have sat and wondered, and then you see it'll come back, then there's only 2 episodes. I mean, with a lot of the shows, it's like, where did it go? It was back, and now it's gone again. And I'm sure it's because they had all these issues that you're talking about.
Yeah, well, our show specifically, CBS has a lot of holiday programming, and then they also have a lot of obligations to sporting events. So we tend to get bumped a lot simply because they have other content that is scheduled, seasonal.
All right, so let's just hit these kind of fast and hard. So let's talk about one of your favorite performances.
Oh, wow. I think, if we want to stay in the vein of Blue Bloods, I don't know if I said this before, but I will say that every job I've had as an actor, from my first job as Frankenstein's monster in the camp musical of Have I Got a Girl for You, that was right out in 1986, my first job in New York, that was the best job I ever had. And then the very next job after that, which was the rehearsing a music job after job, I went, oh, this is even better. Oh, this is even more gratifying. And I can honestly say that about every single job I've had all the way through to where I am now on Blue Bloods, because I never envisioned that I'd have a steady TV job. That's a miracle. That's a gift. And there was an episode where my character and Tom Selleck's character were about to, there was the, although Garrett has threatened to resign Actually, last Friday, I think, was the fourth time. But, or at least that's what we thought was happening, when in fact he didn't. But, oh, wait, spoiler. Sorry for anybody that didn't watch it yet. But there you go. Modern technology. There was an episode where the commissioner's character, played by Tom Selleck, and my character had to express why the commissioner had to told Garrett why he wants him to stay and how much it means to him, and that there's no there, it just wouldn't be the same without you. And they also talked about the hierarchy, that, you know, that Garrett's character, the DCPI, wouldn't be there if it wasn't, wouldn't have the clout that he has, wouldn't have the cachet if it wasn't because he was the commissioner's right-hand man. And it was the scene that was written by Kevin Wade was literally an exact parallel of the life I was living as an actor working with Tom Selleck, who Blue Bloods was the third TV job that he's given me. I mean, he really has been a champion of mine. And when we shot that scene, I was a blubbering idiot because it was so honest. And he and I did the first take and we both went, okay, we can't use that. We're just crying like a couple of whiny babies. He goes, let's do one more. Let's try and do it where we're not, you know, just personalizing it so much and fight against it. And we ended up using one of the two or three later takes because it was still welly. You know, we were still clearly emotionally moved, but you didn't hear me going, which, you know, it was just so nice to be able to,
yeah,
to go, oh man, this is for real. How nice. It was, you know, and so, you know, that's, I loved that. And, you know, the best thing about television is I don't have to tell people about it and they have to take my word for it. You know, like most of my Broadway shows, all this stuff is going to be archived and hopefully syndicated ad nauseum. And right, every once in a while that episode comes up and I'll pull it out of my laptop and watch it and just go, man, I'm lucky, really lucky.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, so it's a little different than favorite. And that one kind of fell into memorable too, but is there something, just a memorable experience that you had that was just like, oh, this was just incredible?
Yeah. When, you know, and it just came up recently, there's a show called Forever Plaid. Mm-hmm. And it's a musical about four young guys who I think are supposed to be in high school, who are on their way to their first gig. And the era is like the late 50s, you know, the era of, you know, guy singing groups. And they end up, and it's a comedy, but it's a musical. And in the story at the beginning of the show, we learn that they were broadsided by a school bus full of girls on their way to see the Beatles at the Ed Sullivan show, and they died. And so the show begins as they're sort of like angels, and they're given the opportunity to perform the one show they never got to do. And that's the conceit. Well, this show, the cast that I was in with Michael Winther and Paul Bonato and Neil Nash, we were cast, and then we opened at the Forge Theater in Washington, D.C. And that was when George W. Bush was president, with Barbara Bush. And they came and saw the show and fell in love with it. And then they invited us to do the show in the East Wing at the White House for the governor's dinner. And then they invited us to do the show up at their house in Kennebunkport when Prime Minister John Major came to visit. And we performed in this historic old casino that's right by the water there in Kennebunkport. And, you know, although I'm a Democrat and a liberal, however, it was an eye-opening experience to see what an amazing, charismatic, kind, and a magnetic man that George Bush was, the senior, mm-hmm. and also to learn that Barbara Bush was the woman behind the man. We were always in a public, you know, performance venue when we were with them. And he would always end up speaking to the group either before or after we performed. And Barb would always be there right at his side, slightly behind, with a hand on his lower back. And as he's like thanking people and saying all the things that, you know, you want, all the people you want to include, whatever that event was, we could see she would give a little tug on his shirt, unperceptible, and say just very quietly, you could see she was saying something that no one could hear. And And she was feeding him, don't forget to say whatever to so-and-so. Don't forget. So. And she was just like literally the safety net that made him, at least in the social situation, such a success. And it was awesome. And being at their house in Kennebunkport, where snipers carrying high-powered rifles in look like rock and roll gig bags are walking the tennis courts, and the top in security are, you know, riding these, what were they called? Are they Scorpion? They were the high-powered boats. We're out on Barb's Fidelity, which is their teak boat they keep at the house. She's taking us out on a spin the day after we performed, and we're being pursued by, you know, the government's finest in protecting the president. And wow. Those are experiences you just kind of go, wow. And that's just because I happened to be in a show that the president liked. And here we are getting to hobnob with, you know, the leaders of the free world. That was pretty cool. And I saw
that is pretty cool. Yeah, I've never heard that story. I love it.
Oh, remind me, I'll send you a photo of the picture of the cast and George and John Major. And we're taking a picture outside the casino. And my favorite part of the whole photo is I'm standing next to Prime Minister John Major. And if you look up the steps behind us, the Secret Service guy is looking at John Major's back, which is where my hand is. And he's like, the guy's looking to go, is that just a hand going on the Prime Minister's back? Or is there a knife going in the, I mean, it was like,
oh my gosh.
You could just tell that nothing was happening at that event that wasn't being, you know, noticed. And right. I love it because that photo captures it, even though I was oblivious to it at the time. It wasn't until after I saw the photo, I went, holy crap, look at these clocking my hand on the Prime Minister's back. But it's like, you go, wow, they had to go through they brought bomb sniffing dogs. They had to clear and clean and approve the entire Ford's Theater, which is a historical landmark, you know, where Lincoln was shot, for one thing. You know, they, of course, didn't want that recurring. Oh, in the show, my character, we do the Ed Sullivan show in like 2.5 minutes. My character brings out a cap gun and shoots a balloon that's on the head of or in the mouth of one of the other actors. Well, that cap gun was, you know, the Secret Service guys had to go through all of our props, and they saw this cap gun. They go, you can't take this on stage. And I went, oh man, go, that's a big gag in this Ed Sullivan sequence. Do you mind if you hold on to it right up until the moment I need it, and I'll take it from you? So you know what it is when I take it on stage. And that was like the negotiating we had to do in order to be able to do that bit. But it was, you know, it was fun. It was exciting.
Yeah.
Great experience.
Yeah. So this is our signature question of the show. And that is, what does working from your happy place mean to you?
I would say working from your happy place means that when you wake up in the morning, you're looking forward to going and doing that thing. Mm-hmm. I can say there was a phase when I was in between jobs and a waiter at the prestigious River Cafe under the Brooklyn Bridge in the late 80s. And it was there was so much pressure, and it was such an environment that I didn't belong in, that I couldn't sleep at night. I was having anxiety attacks. I dreaded going to work because I wasn't as skilled or as facile as all those other amazing career waiters and I got the job because my brother Dan knew the maitre d', and that's how I got the gig. And I didn't belong there, and everybody was carrying me. And the best day was when the general manager and I agreed that it's probably my last day. And it was like, yeah, I gotta go. It was killing me. It was horrible. And gratefully I can't think of a job except for, but yeah, I've been fortunate as an actor that every job I've had or have chosen to take, I've taken it knowing what I want to make sure is that I want to do this every single day that I have to do it. There's no point in doing it if you dread it. I know that that's a luxury. And I suppose the couple of years that we were in LA when we were really pinching pennies but I couldn't take jobs that, you know, were going to make me unhappy or make me miserable, although I was prepared. But you know, I think that's the key. if it's hurting you emotionally, psychologically, physically, even, maybe that's not the right place to be working, you know? I don't know if that's an oversimplification, but.
No, it's interesting on how that means. I've narrowed it down in all of these episodes we've done about, I think we're on like, this is 326. And it's funny because all the answers seem to fall into about one of five categories, which I think is just very interesting on what that question means to people. And so obviously, you know, the whole premise of even when I created the title of Work From Your Happy Place was, if you love what you do, you're never working a day in your life. You know what I mean? It feels good, you're happy. And when that spills over to the happiness in the other areas of your life, which we work so many hours that it can't help but spill into other areas of your life. So you need to love what you do so you can have this fulfilled life. But it is interesting on what that means to people. And I will get the same repetitive answer of the one of five almost every single time. Every once in a while, there's like a rogue answer that is just completely different than everybody else's. But at some point, I am going to publish a book on those five different key answers that most people fall into those categories. So it's interesting.
I can't wait to see that. I look forward to seeing how those all played out.
It really is. Like the episode I did earlier today, he fell definitely into one of those categories. It's I'm happiest when I know I'm making an impact in someone else's life, that I've made somebody else's life better for what I do is when I'm at my happiest. And that's one of the top five answers.
Sure.
But just to get both of the, probably the two most popular ones, both on the same day today, it's just interesting. I love it. It just, it's been an interesting journey for me doing the show and seeing different people's answers and what that means. And I don't know. It's fun.
The decision to leave Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, they offered more money and we said, no, we have to go take care of our boys. That was more important. The leaving Billy Elliot, even saying, I'm done. I can't renew my contract. They said, well, we'll let you go home for a while but it was like, the hurt of missing family, as great as the job was and making money. It was like, my soul is dying because I'm away from my family. So it can be a bunch of different things, but But I still go back to, you know, you can't be dreading it or regretting it, you know?
Mm-mm. Yeah. That's absolutely right. So what advice, I love this part of the show too, would you give, especially to a young person that is, you know, we're going to take this from two different questions. So we're going to split it in half here, but let's start with the obvious one, a young person who's thinking about getting into the arts. And what advice would you give to them?
So I only have my personal journey, which was parents said, no, you're not going to be a theater major at University of Michigan. You're going to be a communications major because we don't know anybody who made a living in the arts. And we don't want to be supporting you after you get out of college. And so you go to college going, okay, you bet, work at the TV station, be a communications major. But then while you're at college, you are finding out that all you want to do is audition for the shows. And then you keep getting cast in those shows and you're going, wow, I'm being supported. Like the things I want to do, they're going, yeah, you belong here. And then you kind of go to your parents who agree that you have this ability, but it's a terrifying unknown. You go, I'm changing my major. And then they cut you off. They say, well, we can't fund your school anymore. Even though they love you and support you. I mean, they do emotionally. They're afraid that you're going to, you know, end up an impoverished artist. But I really believed and I kept going after it. And everything I kept doing kept confirming what I believed and the people that I revered who they kept encouraging it. So, you know, but it was active. It wasn't, so young people, I would say the thing you go, oh, that's what I really want to do. Completely immerse yourself in it. Go after it. Like, you know, people go, oh, I have a dream about being something. You're not going to become something because you dream about it. You're going to become something because you go after it. And And that's the greatest honor and service you can do to yourself and all the people who love you, is to take the time to figure out what that is and then go get it. And then if it doesn't come to fruition, you're going to know, because it's not, it's painful and it's not rewarding and it's not going where you thought it would. And then you'll have the opportunity to rethink what it is you think you want. And, you know, that can always change, but, you know, don't sit back and wait for something to fall in your lap. Go, what do I want? I mean, other than playing video games and having money just fall out of trees for you, because I don't think that's happening. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what do you want? And then get it. And then if it doesn't come together for you, the process will teach you more about yourself. And then you'll find whatever that next thing is that you want to get. And then chase that too, because that's where the gratification comes. You'll never go, oh, I wonder if. You know, right. Oh, I should have. Don't ever be a I should have or I wonder if person. Go find out. Go get it and know whether it's for you to have or not. And you'll come away more fulfilled and happy and not, what's the right word? Resentful.
Right.
You know?
It's funny. You shared a very similar advice in the episode we did 5 years ago. So you were consistent with that answer. That's awesome. Well, but I have shared that with Olivia over and over and over, that story. And she now says to me, but the truth of it is, and she does know this, you have to work hard. I think that is sometimes what people also aren't willing to put the work in. And you have to master your craft. You have to try to be the best. If that's what you really want to do, then you have to be the best at it.
You must be the best at whatever it is you're going to pursue.
Right.
That has to be the driving force. Otherwise,
absolutely.
Otherwise, it's not the thing that you want to do. Really.
So I'm always telling her, you got to work hard. You got to stay focused. And she'll always say to me, I know, Mom, I know, just like Greg. I know what Greg says.
Yeah, but she's listening. I mean, she's rocking it. Yeah,
she is. She's working hard.
She does.
She does get it. I have seen her, you know, we will put her in a room and do an audition. And I've seen her do it and watch it back and do it and watch it back. And I've seen her do 35 takes before she sends the one she wants. You know what I mean?
That's outstanding. And I don't know where she would get that from her parents. I mean, I know her mother was like first chair drummer at birth. I can still picture you in All City Band. It was like, man, you were that force. Not only were you talented.
That's the first time we met. It was an All City Band.
I know. Was it grade school or was it junior high? It was grade school, fifth or sixth, right?
I think the first All City Band was that sixth grade, but then we really met each other in seventh, eighth grade
All City?
In All City. Yep.
Oh, that was the best.
It was.
Of many things.
Of many, many times.
Yeah.
So here's my second part of that question, and the reason I'm asking this is there are so many people that have sort of been displaced in this last year, and they are waking up and going, you know what? Life's too short, and I'm not going to be stuck in this job I don't want anymore, and I am going to pursue something different. And I had one lady on my show at 65 years old pursued a career in stand-up comedy, which has been pretty amazing. But
that's great. That's beautiful.
I know. It's an awesome, beautiful story. And so what advice would you give to anyone that feels like, am I too old to even get started on this?
I don't think there's ever too old for anything, right?
Right.
Because then that's kind of like surrendering to the, oh, I missed my chance. Oh, what if? You don't want to feed that ever. I don't think, I don't believe in too old. I mean, yeah, I don't believe, especially with the technology that's out there today. There are so many, hopefully if COVID taught us anything, is that you can do it with your laptop in the solitary of your own home. You can accomplish ridiculous things and have it be seen and or appreciated by whomever or whoever you're trying to reach out to. So yeah, I would say you're never too old. That's for sure. For anything.
And then what advice would they do to even get started?
Hmm. because it bring that just immediately brings to question, like you go, the people who just go, well, I wouldn't know where to start. And I go, And I go, do you know how to operate a computer? And then they go, well, yeah, of course. Great. Then you need, then take some time and just do some research and read about something. Even if you don't know what that is, but if you know you're not happy with what you're doing, put the question in the, in Google search. I'm currently a blah, 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 and I hate my job. What are my other options? I mean, I would imagine that would bring up something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just like there really there's with because of the internet, there really everything is actually all the information you need is at your fingertips.
And now there's so many masterclasses and anything that you want to learn more about is also at your fingertips.
Yeah, right. You go, I wonder if I would like that. Let me look at a YouTube video about it and go, oh, that looks like something I would enjoy, right? I mean, there's no reason to surrender to, oh, it's too late for me. There really isn't. That there's no need. You don't have to. You don't have to accept that. I don't believe that.
Well, that is awesome. And this has been so fun catching up with you.
I know it has.
I know. And just hearing about all things going on in New York and with the show. And congratulations. You know, I didn't even realize it had been 12 seasons. That seems crazy.
Yeah, we start 12, season 12, on last week of July. Isn't that crazy?
Wow.
I know.
So what are you going to do with this time off before you have to go back?
Well, I'm home in L.A. Our oldest just drove up from school. So Aiden's got a baseball game tomorrow. What day of the week? Is it Tuesday? Yeah. We're going to go to Aiden's high school varsity baseball game tomorrow. We have to sit outside the perimeter of the campus. Can't go in. And Zach says he's going to take me flying on Friday for a little sunset cruise. So, you know, my dance card's full. It's the first time we've had all four of us under one roof in 2021. So my wife and I are, you know, just so happy to have.
Oh, of course. Oh, well, that's awesome. Enjoy your time.
Thank you.
For sure. And thanks once again for taking the time to be on our show and share with our listeners. I appreciate it so much.
I appreciate you and the fact that, and you must take this credit. I wouldn't be where I am today if we weren't friends way back in the day. Think of all the influence we've had on our lives, you know, the shared experiences. I'm grateful to reminisce and give credit where it's due. And I'm very proud of you. And thank you for always including me.
Well, thank you, Greg. And to all of our listeners, thanks so much for tuning in today. If you enjoyed the show today, make sure you hit subscribe or follow. That way you won't miss a single episode. And the best form of compliment that we can have is to share it with a friend. So we'll see you next time on Work From Your Happy Place.
Thanks for joining us at Work From Your Happy Place. If you like what you hear, please share it with your friends. And be sure to rate and review us on iTunes or Stitcher. For a free gift on finding your own happy place, please visit workfromyourhappyplace.com and click on the free audio button. Thanks again for listening.